Thank you very much for being here. You have been working on radicalization and jihadism in the United States and in Europe in comparative perspective. I would like to ask you bluntly, what are the differences? What are the differences and what are the resemblances?
Yeah. Well, I think the big difference that is the most evident is the size of the problem. You have, to some degree, the same dynamics of radicalization in terms of the diversity of the backgrounds of people. I think it's probably even more marked in the US, where you have a really diverse group of people, but I think it's also true in Europe. But it's the sheer size of the problem. Just to use some numbers that are, to some degree, indicators. In the US, you have between 100 and 150 people who went to Syria and Iraq to fight. Compare that to European countries. Out of a population of 3 million Muslims, it's a very, very small number. We've seen less than 100 people arrested for ISIS-related activities. That is, even though the FBI uses very aggressive tactics, which very few European law enforcement agencies use, yet 90 people. I would argue that if the French or the German or the British government were to use the same aggressive law enforcement tactics, the numbers of people arrested would be much, much higher than 90. So what we have in the U.S. is we don't really have the size of the problem, and I would argue that's for two main reasons. One is the different demographics of the Muslim community in the U.S. That's the most commonly argued point, is that, you know, the American Muslim population is very well integrated, which is indeed very true, and so is more resistant, more resilient to radicalization. I mean, that's a very valid point, although I don't think it should be seen as a gospel, as really the antidote. We do see, whether in Europe or in the United States, that plenty of people who radicalize are quite well integrated. If you look at the attacks in Chattanooga and San Bernardino, both perpetrators in both attacks were the quintessential models of integration, yet they clearly radicalized. And I think there's a larger debate about the relationship between integration or lack thereof and radicalization. It's not as simple as that. But indeed, the fact that American Muslim communities are, generally speaking, with a few exceptions, like the Somalis, for example, but generally well integrated, is partially an antidote, I would say a partial antidote. I think there's a second reason, which probably, in my opinion, is more important, is that we don't see in the U.S. The same pipelines, the same scene, the same filière like you have here, whether it's the Salafist, non-jihadist Salafist scene, which in some cases then leads to a more more violent and more militant approach. We've never seen the Sharia 4, the Forsani al-Itza, these sort of groups which then lead to let some people to go to Syria and so on. That scene does not exist in the States. We don't see the radical mosques. We don't see those organizations. Or we see them in a very, very tiny size. And we don't see the recruiters. I mean, it's much more, we see a very few of them. If you radicalize even independently and you live in any large or mid-sized European city, it's very easy to directly or indirectly come across people who are recruiters, who can help you, who are facilitators, who can help you go to Syria and Iraq. That is not the case in the States. It's much more difficult. If you live in rural Mississippi and you embrace ISIS ideology, and we have seen cases like that, the only avenue you have to establish that contact is the internet. And it's obviously not as easy to do it online from Mississippi rather than you do it in a certain neighborhood where you know people directly. Add to that the FBI lures on the internet and looks for people who are there looking for contacts, that explains why I think you don't have that size for mobilization.
Why black people who have Muslim faith in the United States do not get radicalized? They did it, you know, in the 1970s, 1960s, you know, some people, and then some American Muslims, you know, who reinvented some kind of Islamic faith, you know, and radicalized. But now they are quiet. I mean, none of those people who were arrested in the United States, for instance, are black people of, you know, of Muslim faith. You know, could you explain that, or just give some information about that? Yeah. Perhaps there are some.
Very few. I mean, the reality is that the majority, there's a sizable number of people in the African American community who belong to the Nation of Islam or other groups that to some degree are part of that brand of Islam. They, of course, have a message that is very antagonistic, very militant, but it's not necessarily violence. There's occasional violence within those groups, but it has very rarely manifested in any, especially over the last 20 years, in any violence against the U.S., against
or
any kind of
pro-Syrian or pro.
No.
Why? I mean, they
remain very into their own message that has to do with America. They're not really into any kind of globalized message. And there's also to be said that that brand of Islam is seen as non-Islam by militant Sunnis, and I would say also by a lot of non-militant Sunnis. It is a very particular form of Islam. I mean, I'm not engaging takfir myself, but I'm saying there's quite a few people, even non-militant, that would argue that it's not really Islam for a variety. It's more like a cult for any variety of reasons. But a lot of mainstream Sunnis would argue that, let alone some Salafist or militant circles, they really despise that kind of Islam. You do have other people from the African American community. In some cases, they are children of people that are in the Nation of Islam that then make the leap into Sunni Islam. Or anyway, one pattern or the other, they are Sunni Muslims. But generally speaking, they're not necessarily part of any kind of militant scene. We have seen a few cases. We have seen, but again, you can count them on one hand, cases of prison radicalization in African-American cases where then became somewhat jihadist wannabes. But again, also there's indeed some prison radicalization issues in the States with the African-American community with becoming Muslims. A lot of these people, once they leave prison, they actually leave Islam behind them. It's a clear case of prison conversion for all the perks or the protection that comes with converting in prison, but it's not genuine. We've had a few cases. Of the 94 people who have been arrested for ISIS-related activities in the States, African-American, I believe, are 3 or 4.
That's it. So it's really a tiny proportion.
Tiny proportion. And except one case, we had two cousins in Illinois who are African-American. The other couple of cases were people who were part of a more multi-ethnic little cluster. So you were like second generation, one was of Arab descent, one was a white convert, one was a black, where ethnicity really didn't matter. So it's not really a phenomenon. You have, yes, pockets that embrace certain somewhat antagonistic brands of Islam, but as a separate universe from the jihadist scene.
But there's a paradox. American policy, towards the Muslim world, is perceived by many Muslims as being antagonistic to them. I mean, towards the Palestinians, towards the Iraqis, the American invasion with the Great Britain, of course, and so on. And in spite of that, radicalization occurs in Europe, not in the United States. How could you explain that? I mean, from your perspective in Washington.
I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to say. I think we talked about the two reasons that I would give. It's a very different Muslim community that is suburban, wealthy, educated, and well integrated. As we said, plenty of examples of people who are suburban, well integrated, well educated, affluent, who radicalized. But again, we're talking of anecdotes, a few examples here and there. You don't have the neighborhoods, the clusters of disenfranchisement that you have in other places. Once you have a pocket like that, for example, Minneapolis, there you see some dynamics that are similar to Europe on a relatively small scale, but we have seen there a pipeline with a few dozen people who have gone from Minneapolis first to join al-Shabaab in 2006, 2007, and then over the last 3 or 4 years going to Syria. So, but that's, in a way, from a sociological point of view, that's an exception in the American scenery. Then there's the lack of recruiters, of structures, of infecting clusters. When you don't have a scene of radical mosques, of radical preachers, of radical elements, then it's very difficult. Yes, the internet obviously to some degree compensates that, but only to some degree. It's a very different dynamic.
And the lack of a kind of, I would say, post-colonial syndromes.
That also helps.
Because, you know, in Europe, many middle-class people, you know, young people got involved who are really not well-off, but belong to the middle classes. They do not belong anymore to the disaffected youth. In spite of that, you know, there is a feeling that there is a historical background that is still, you know, alive in an imaginary manner among them, and which is lacking in the United States.
Yeah, there is obviously some, as you correctly said, yes, there's lack of colonial history and baggage there. At the same time, obviously, the United States has been, obviously for the last 20, 30 years at least, the target of not just Islamists, but a lot of resentment throughout the Middle East, not just in jihadist and Islamist quarters. Yet that doesn't really translate into that kind of jihadist radicalization. For I think the two factors that I mentioned is the good integration and the lack of infecting clusters, I think are the two main reasons. This is something might be changing. It's difficult to foresee the future with some of the discourse that we've seen, the very strong anti-Muslim sentiments, which I think we've seen stronger.
Neocons and so on, and, and new intellectuals, you know, who are treating Islam as a fake religion and so on.
And I think that debate is stronger now than it was after 9/11. It's paradoxically really gotten stronger now, the elections and everything. It's very vitriolic. It's very strong. And I mean, listen, most of the people, we did a study in my center where we looked at the background of these 94 individuals, at the time it was 80, but the individuals arrested for ISIS-related activities. These are almost all U.S.-born. These are American kids. Mm-hmm. And to them, partially it's an American mindset. They're a bit, of course they care about Syria, they care about Palestine, they care about Somalia, but they really care about American. They're very American, whether they like it or not. They are very American. And to them, it's more about, they're interested more in Ferguson and the race tensions there.
Exactly.
And Trump and Ben Carson and all these kind of issues that have popped up. We follow online what their discourse is. And I would say it's more the domestic stuff than the foreign stuff. And I think, it has become very different from a few years back, the kind of vitriol there, the kind of events that have taken place in the States, and maybe people outside the States have not paid attention to that much. There was a protest in front of a Phoenix mosque with people, because it's legal in Arizona, with people with automatic weapons protesting, saying Islam out of the States. When you have people in military fatigue with automatic weapons protesting outside, that sends a certain message. That stuff was more viral in American jihadist circle than, anti-Assad propaganda or anything about Israel or Somalia or Kashmir or whatever, because they're American and they care a lot about America.
Thank you very much indeed, my colleague.
Absolutely.
Very rich. Thank you.
All right, pleasure.